applying Gadamer's ideas to the study of religions, different issues in the study of religions, and I'm trying to hit lots of key debates, like nature of text, insider outsider debate, nature of the self, nature of religious belief, conceptions of religion and conceptions of spirituality, approaches to practice, etc., etc. And that involves, from my side, a twofold process, where A, I work out Gadamer's position on these issues. Right, coming from, you know, he writes on hermeneutics, and he says in his writing that he's applying this actually more broadly. He writes on hermeneutics of text, also on the history of philosophy, and on cultural studies and the humanities more broadly. So he writes a lot on like Giambattista Vico and Alexander von Humboldt, and the whole of Diltai and all the cultural, the whole of cultural studies. And I have to take that and kind of apply it, as he does a bit in the later part of his career, to these other issues. So that's the first thing I'm trying to do in these, but I also need to apply them specifically to what is happening in those individual study of religions debates. And that means these rough drafts also need to be taken into greater conversation with the kind of things that are happening right now. It's a bit like going to the AAR, listening to what everyone says in their groovy panels, and then like applying it wildly as fast, going, well, Gadamer's answer is blah, blah, blah. And so that's kind of part of the process that's happening here. So anything that you want to bring to this and say, hey, how does that apply to this? Or that seems the opposite of this, or that seems to go along with this, will be really useful. Because in a way, what I'm doing is trying to gather up these different sort of points of reference that this can speak to in the academy, in the study of religions, and of anthropology, and of cultural studies. So study of religions, very widely conceived, I think. So yeah, all comments, not only welcome, but they will be rapaciously assimilated into whatever I have to write.
May I perhaps ask, why Gadamer?
Good question. The answer to these things is always complicated. On the one hand, it's just the person that you know best. But you know, when you start to do your PhD or your work on a particular theorist because they're useful and you gradually come to understand them better and better and they come to sort of shape your view, that works. In some cases, that happens because they turn out, if you understand them rightly, to be right about a lot of stuff. And I think what I found out with Gadamer is that he's by far the least glamorous of the phenomenologists, of a lot of the cultural theorists out there. He's not like the Marxist critical school, where it's an exciting revealing of hidden power relations. He's not like Derrida and the French, who are constantly challenging, expanding, and complexifying our vision of the world. He's not like, you know, Charles Taylor, who has an explicit agenda, etc. He doesn't fit into a lot of those more polemical and rhetorical, exciting spaces. But I think what he's trying to do, something humble but I think good, he's trying to say, here is a basic truth about the nature of all meaning. And by meaning, that means both the world as we experience it and cultural text in its many different forms. So it's actually a universal insight, and he talks a lot about the universal insight of hermeneutics, and people just thought he meant words, but he means something bigger. And I think his little insight actually does have an enormous implication. It means redefining lots of different things in both the spheres of truth and discourse and of ontology itself. He's actually much more metaphysical a thinker than a lot of people give him credit for, partly because it's very unfashionable to be metaphysical after Nietzsche, but he says actually he has things to say about that.
The later Gadamer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
No, so you're asking, do I mean the later Gadamer?
Yes.
I think they're linked. So truth and method, if truth and method is the early Gadamer, I mean, there is no real early Gadamer, because he writes it when he's like, it's published when he's about 60. So you can say there's that Gadamer, and then there's the much later Gadamer, who in his 80s is publishing essays on ethics, hermeneutics, education, medicine, psychology, social institutions. But I think he doesn't have a turn, put it this way. There's no turn in Gadamer. Mm-hmm. Yep. There's just the point at which he realizes that truth and method is really obscure. And the idea at the heart of it, nobody got. Like, he really suffered a lot. For 15 years after he published it, people were like, has anyone read that? You know, we have quotes from other scholars like Heidegger going, has anyone read that book? I don't know. It really wasn't the most impressive. It's a bit obscure, no? And his wife and his friends at the time he's writing it would complain that he gets lost in gads. They had a word for, you know, when you get lost on a side discussion that goes off in some distant direction and eventually comes back to your point. There were so many of them that they called them gads, short for Gadamer. And he said, yes, and he knows he has that problem. So he kind of goes through a process of unpacking this basic insight and truth and method into its implications for the wider world. And kind of dealing with that, and I think it's quite interesting because he does unpack it into, you know, poetry, into ethics, into medicine, into humanities. He talks about science, he talks about all these different areas. So that, in a way, I'm trying to bring that to this. And it's important because in the time that I first started doing the study of religions, people were obsessed with things like the insider-outsider debate. Is there such a thing as English students were doing? Is there an author? Anthropology was worried about whether or not they could ever understand another culture. And now we have issues like cultural pluralism, the social construction of the self. People are really almost taking culture as the medium that we have to think through to think any problem. And Gadamer is the guy who kind of gives us keys to that. You know, in a way, I think the reason why Gadamer is that his hermeneutics has become the answer to most of the questions that confused people in the second half of the 20th century. Right? Derrida's challenge to meaning gets quietly solved by hermeneutics, and for a long time, you look at books, people would cite Truth and Method, not extensively because they couldn't be bothered to read it, but they knew that Truth and Method was the answer to the problems that had been asked for a long time about whether you can understand anyone, what is communication, how does discourse function, etc. So it's kind of important. So it's kind of a key insight that's already at the foundations of all that we're doing in the humanities in the modern world, but where the more interesting implications haven't actually been brought out. So it's kind of a lost opportunity, and it's time to bring it out a little bit more. I also like him because he's not polemical. He's not trying to tell you how you should do stuff in the sense of we need to fight power, we need to impose power, we need to save the world. He's reluctant to do that, I think partly because of his experience of the Second World War, where all of his friends were, before the Second World War, major figures get caught up in National Socialism and produce dodgy polemic. And after the Second World War, he starts off in East Germany and eventually gets a job in West, but everybody is caught up into the communist and the sort of left perspective, which is also a complicated, not ethically compromising in the way that National Socialism was, but also a very constrictive ideology that I think, again, in the 80s, 90s, until that period, was really determining the way a lot of people had to write about things. You know, still in Hindu studies, it's still very much present. Sheldon Pollock, all these characters are still, in a way, channeling critical theory, and which is good. But we get a bit stuck with the same messages over and over again in a way. So, what I'm going to do is read out some stuff that try to convey Gadamer's view on the self, where selfhood is a topic that gets mostly associated, I think. And when I think of those writers, those scholars and thinkers and philosophers who speak about the self, I immediately think of Michel Foucault and Charles Taylor. Am I missing major voices that have brought... Because for a while, every conference was about the self. Every theme was on the self. And it seems to me that those are two of the thinkers who really made self a central theme in the humanities and in the study of religion. Is there someone else we'd want to bring to that conversation particularly? I guess Ricoeur is someone in philosophy who asks for that concept to be reconsidered.
Would you make a distinction to a person? Mm-hmm. You could bring muscle mouse into it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The models of the human and
person. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And it also, all of this, of course, links to individuals and individuals, as it were, the relation to society, and to the rise shortly after the study of the self that shifted into study of the body, mm-hmm. as the mediation of the self, and that again was quite a Foucauldian kind of a move.
Maybe McIntyre was Taylor.
Yeah, that's helpful. And indeed, philosophy of mind and sort of Wittgensteinian thinking also shifted the way people wanted to treat this.
You sort of have subfields that emerge from those narrative, then phenomenology also dealing with it.
Yeah, that's right. With Ricoeur, you get people like Merleau-Ponty wanting to kind of realign the way that we conceive these things. Well, one of the things that, I mean, in some ways those examples bring out the way in which the move towards thinking about the self has often gone along with what you might call social constructivism. So the way that the self is constructed culturally or indeed socially. And I think that's one of the themes that I want to press against with the way that Gadamer does this, that the, if you like, the centripetal way of looking at the self, so the society presses inward on the self and defines the self, needs to be counterbalanced by a centrifugal way of looking at the self. So the self also presses outward and changes society. So you can't just reduce the self, if you like. And that's a theme that I'm interested in relation to actually religious subjectivity and religious experience, that we tend to treat the religious subject as something constructed by their society. And there's a lot of good material on the importance of that and the ways in which it's done. Ritual is often interpreted in that way. Gavin's wonderful book, The Tantric Body, you know, really goes into detail on the processes by which cultural text gets inscribed upon the self. But I think I am interested in the way in which Gadamer both acknowledges that, absolutely, but also challenges it at the level of a basic philosophical insight into how that happens and reminds us that the self is always also self-making and society-making. So that's that centrifugal force. Okay, so if I read for a bit, we can open it up again. So self has been a central category for the humanities and for religious studies in particular since a number of key publications and thinkers brought it to the fore. Michel Foucault's study of technologies of the self derived from his own examination of ascetic traditions and his insight into the way in which religion speaks, in studying religious traditions, he sees how it speaks of, quote-unquote, the obligation to tell the truth, of hiding what one does, and of deciphering who one is in cultures of self-examination, self-revelation through things like confession, and also self-control in things like the Platonic heritage. So we have religion as something that is about this mediation of self in an explicit way. And particularly Foucault in terms of religion as the point of tension between external and internal forces. So hence Foucault's interest in sexuality, he says. He says we're always asked to examine ourselves in religion, culture, and I think all communication. You somehow express certain parts of yourself. But he says this is there's a very special case that is seen in desire, and particularly in sexual desire, because you always have to examine what is actually maybe quite obscure but quite powerful within yourself. Right? So sexual desire challenges our expression in certain important ways. From his work, the self-shaping that takes place through all culture, but particularly through religion, became a central theme for religious studies. And Foucault does both want to, in a kind of critical theory mode, unmask the way that the self is controlled. But he also, I think in his later work particularly, wants to remind us that there is a creative art of self-shaping, that the technology of the self can be an art of the self as well. Charles Taylor's Sources of the Self followed this with a study of the making of the modern self in the Western world, looking here not at the proscription of desire, so negative approaches to what we seem to naturally want and how that has to be restricted, but rather in a more positive mode at the way in which positive values are embedded within identity. So he says you can't have a self without having certain values for what you care about, value, move towards, etc., inscribed within that identity. So a more positive, potentially a more positive account of what the value-laden self entails. In both cases, study of the self went with a certain sense that the self is constructed socially, but also creatively by the individual him or herself. And thus, due to the constructivist assumptions of the modern approach, cultural history is recast as a battleground in which the individual and the corporate forces of society struggle for control of the human soul, which is seen as something malleable. In many ways, the account of self that underpins Gadamer's hermeneutics reflects the same 20th century fascination with cultural constructivism and humanity's struggle to regain power over its own identity. His hermeneutic concern means that he enters the debate at the level of a close study of the cultural materiality in which we were clothed, where culture functions as the body that we inhabit. Right, so in a way, if on the constructivist model culture is making the person that we are, it's giving us the material, then he's looking at the flesh that culture provides us to live in and through. Right, that's what it is to study text. Again, text is not just specific text, it's the whole text of meaning that is made available by our culture. So culture becomes a kind of flesh of ideas, customs, assumptions, allusions, and symbols through which we live. And different cultures offer different bodies in which we can clothe ourselves. So that religion becomes typically both a material for making the space, both a material for making the self and a space in which to pause and reflect on the motives of this making. So we see a twofold model of religion, where it both gives us the flesh that we become, but it also tends, and I think he would argue, to open out a space in which you get to reflect on that very flesh that you are. Right? So religions form you, but they also give you time to think about that formation. Not always the case, but there'd be an interesting way of kind of reflecting on religions as tending to embody both of those different processes. And potentially also for giving you the tools for taking control over it. In this chapter, what I'm doing here is to look at what it is that constitutes the body and also potentially the soul, the inner aspect of this self. So the making of the self, there's little discussion of the self in Gadamer's work on the whole. That word comes up relatively rarely. And he's quite wary of what he calls philosophies of the subject. So he talks about the subject a lot, but usually through the work of Husserl, occasionally Heidegger, although again the subject is kind of messy there. But he looks at it through particularly the work of the key phenomenologist who he inherits. And subject has its own history in German thought. This is partly because his German phenomenological background makes him careful to avoid anything that might make him seem allied with idealism. Right? This is a big fear for the Germans. He criticizes what he calls subjectism as a misleading detour in the history of phenomenology, anything that takes consciousness, world, meaning, and locates it in the subject. Right? Because this is the route towards idealism, and through idealism to solipsism, which is kind of the tragic end of that way of looking at consciousness for the German tradition, right? Everyone's scared of becoming a super idealist and thus a solipsist, and that answer tended to be kind of rejected by the tradition. It appears to locate the world within the subject, denying it proper reality and any shared significance as a communal sphere. One of the problems of idealism is that it can appear to isolate individuals in separate nodes, as it were.
What would be the references for idealism? Hegel apart?
That's a very good question. I think he doesn't see Hegel as an idealist.
No, no.
But he'd be thinking more about... I mean, it's a good question.
Are there actually any position who would take that?
I think usually people would ally that... Ironically, the true idealists tend to be the British. Berkeley, for instance.
Okay.
Leibniz, doesn't need to be seen that way. Spinoza doesn't need to be seen that way. Hegel doesn't need to be seen that way. Schelling, who he talks about, doesn't need to be seen that way. Because they all, actually, the problem is all of them would say, so here is consciousness and it's all contained in consciousness. The world is the world of consciousness. Consciousness and world are allied. And if you assume that consciousness is something happening in people's heads, that means you're always relocating the world within the mind. And all of those thinkers then who make an alliance of being and consciousness can be suspected of doing that. So the problem is that most people who read those thinkers don't recognize that they also make an ontological transition where they're not... So either you're Descartes and you're going, oh my God, is consciousness in my head or out there? Or you're in the German tradition, which in Hegel does not say consciousness is in here and the world is out there, but rather they're two parts of the same phenomenon. Right, and what they're not doing is saying, and that phenomenon is happening in the head.
Yeah.
Because they've already said the head and the world are actually part of the same thing. But for a lot of, particularly analytic philosophers, every time you say they're part of the same thing, you know, spirit, Geist in Hegel is something that unites the inner and the outer. The analytic philosopher goes on and says, well, if that's linked to consciousness, then it's obviously in the head. So what about the outside world? And the, you know, Hegelian on this model comes back and says, no, we're not talking about the outside world. And they say, but that means you're locating it in the head. It's kind of a confusion, a mistake that can go on happening again and again and again.
It would be very interesting how that relates to the understanding of relating in India, South Asia. But
indeed. And it reminds us that the Cartesian dualist assumption of what is in and what is out should not necessarily be imposed on all models of what experience is, right? And that tends to happen, and that tends to be where analytic philosophy maintains that basic distinction. Analytic philosophy is very much premised on trying to understand how thought and language relate to their external references. And because that's the basic model for that whole mode of analysis, you're always replicating the Cartesian assumption. In the Indian context, the Western view, of course, is partly then, you know, from Descartes to Kant, modern Western philosophy is premised on the way in which Kant questions that. It'd be interesting in the Indian context to say, how does that work? Is there, I think it's not so much to say, is there an idealism in India, but rather to say, was dualism ever in place in the first place? Or how is dualism in place in the first place in India? Not in quite the same form as Descartes. So that those, for instance, who interpret Samkhya in terms of dualism are missing something, which includes the idea that for Samkhya, thought is part of Prakriti, not part of Purusha, if you see what I mean. So it's just not a dualism quite that way. It's its own thing, not to reduce it to either model.
And how that would relate to the reception history, especially in Germany and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a shame. Well, indeed, that's part of that whole mystery of how to relate German philosophy in that tradition to the Indian heritage, which is a very contested and complicated thing. Yeah, famously, Indians loved Hegel. A lot of them got taught a lot of Hegel, and they found it great, very intuitively appealing. Whether or not they got it right, whether or not the Germans got India right, is another issue. I mean, clearly they both did and didn't. It's always a complicated translation. So that's kind of his concern about not appearing to be an idealist. And so in that sense, self is something he wants to be cautious about talking of. And if you just read through the text for that word, it can appear to have relatively little significance for Gadamer. But he does address the topic, both through the model of self that is implicit in his hermeneutics, so you can work out what he actually thinks about it from the way that he understands the process of interpretation, and also what he writes on the history of the subject in Western philosophy. So a good place to look for that is his collection of essays called Philosophical Hermeneutics, in which he reflects on the phenomenological tradition quite a lot, and indeed has essays on the subject. Within the process of hermeneutic interpretation, so to take that insight and unpack it, the self appears as a node or a nexus in the web of ideas. So what's happening, we talked about this a little bit last time, but for Gadamer, what's happening in both text and in reality, the two really being kind of the same thing, is that you have a series of meanings, let's call them ideas, right? If you want to use the Platonic model, you can call them the ideas. But meanings in general, which includes all experience, and they are interwoven constantly, so you never have an isolated idea. It always is associated with other ideas. It is always manifesting in a particular context or environment, in a particular moment. It's being performed. It's always, therefore, changing. It's always, therefore, shifting according to the person in whom that idea is being kind of explored. Every time you communicate it or express it, it's changing as it moves into that new environment. What I say moves into your worldview or horizon and becomes a new idea. So it's a web, if you like, because all ideas are interconnected. It's dynamic because it's always being manifested in new contexts and forms. And no idea is ever a single stable thing, in a sense. So for him, that's really important. And what is the self in that context? If you look at his analysis of the notion of play, in one of the early sections of Truth and Method. He uses play as an ontological model. He says it's what the self is really the point of constant interaction within that web of ideas. It's the place where an existing worldview meets a new idea and worldview, and new ideas are emerging. Right, so the self is actually a generative process. So in the process of hermeneutic interpretation, the self appears as a node or nexus in the web of ideas. It is the point of interpretation where the ideas in the text meet any particular worldview and its given context to engage and negotiate new meaning. It is thus defined as the meeting place of multiple environments or horizons or worldviews, all these different words can be used, or multiple texts. And also as a process of generation in which new such ideas come to be. So it's an encounter and a generative phenomenon. Understood in terms of the power relations implicit in constructivism, this process can be expressed in at least two different directions, what I've called the centrifugal and centripetal. On the one hand, so centripetally, society holds the power to determine the self's basic framework for all its thinking and acting. It does this through its inherited form as tradition. So when you see the cultural text as tradition, you see the centripetal aspect. Tradition is an established set of assumptions and predispositions that are always already in place for any given subject. So we emerge into an already established text. This is expressed in the notion of effective historical consciousness for Gadamer, Wirkungsgeschichtliche Bewusstsein. And is this that led Jürgen Habermas and his fellow critical theorists to take Gadamer to be proposing a traditionalist view of the world. So Gadamer was, when Truth and Method came out and finally got to be read and understood, it was attacked from two sides. One side said it was too conservative, it was too much imposing culture and society onto the individual, it was closing down creativity. And that was Habermas and the critical theorists who were interested in the idea of pressing against tradition, allowing new revolution, partly because they're very much emerging from the left orientation of Germany at the time. So they proposed Gadamer to be offering a traditionalist view of the world. Gadamer had pointed out that historical predispositions are embedded in every learning of language and custom, of every most basic idea and form of expression that we learn. So there's no point at which we have an idea that is not formed by culture. They thus could not be avoided. Religions, then, act as formative templates for all those selves that come within their influence, and potentially leading to a radical constructivist view. And indeed, Habermas interpreted this in terms of dominant social cultures. But that's really important. That's where they get it wrong. So you imagine a culture as a template expressed through institutions and texts that get stamped onto the raw material of the subject. But that's a very naive and simplistic view of what a culture is, and indeed links to the word tradition as something that is seen as only the dominant parts that are continuous through time from kind of authority structures and top down. But a culture obviously isn't just that. Gadamer's point was much more universally applicable than the cultural model. Not only culture, but history itself, with all its variations and vicissitudes, are channeled into the formation of each individual. In this sense, Gadamer is more Hegelian than Marxist in his approach to this idea. Remember, Marxist is concerned with society power structures, whereas Hegel's notion of Geist is much larger than that. Right, so the left Hegelians try to interpret him just in terms of cultural impositions. But right Hegelians have their problems, but you do at least remember that Geist is something that includes all thought, all manifestation, the subtleties as well as the big power authorized ideas. This can be seen in Gadamer's own interpretation of Hegel's philosophy. He quotes Hegel's description of the way in which a girl, so Hegel talks about a girl in an orchard, he quotes Hegel's description from the Phenomenology of Spirit of the way in which a girl is a product not only of her society but of her environment in toto, both man-made and natural, mainstream and marginal, just as a fruit is the product of many forces that shape a tree. This is a quote from Phenomenology of Spirit. Hegel says, just as the girl who presents the plucked fruit in an orchard is more the nature that presented it in the first place, with all of its conditions and elements, trees, air, light, and so on, insofar as she combines all of these in a higher way in the light of self-consciousness in her eyes and in her gestures. So also the spirit of destiny, which gives us works of art, is the spirit of tragic fate that gathers all these individual gods and attributes of substance within one pantheon into spirit conscious of itself as spirit. And Hegel's idea is that you've got nature with all of its different factors creates the tree, creates the apple, and she, in taking the apple and offering it as part of herself, a manifestation of that process, the natural process, adds something more on top of it, which is self-consciousness, in which all of it becomes combined in a new way that is perhaps in its self-consciousness more explicitly creative. So Gadamer's Hegelian example demonstrates the other direction in which the constructivist impulse can be interpreted. Society provides material for the embodiment of the self, but the self, through its own embodiment of inherited cultural material, also makes society. Self-formation is far more than the stamping of a dominant ideology onto the raw material of a naive subject. It is the continuing of life of many conditions and elements, reminding us to treat each religious culture as a matrix of multiple influences. The light of self-consciousness in her eyes and her gestures cannot, for Gadamer, be taken as a simple reflection of religious texts that have influenced her. Rather, a more sophisticated hermeneutic view takes these perceived fronts of the individual, so the eyes, the face, the gestures, to reflect the product of subtle interactions between the many strands of a culture's multiple ideologies. Alongside the specific history of environment, interaction, and inner life of that individual person, that have all together affected the way in which these external cultural influences are assimilated. So the culture gives you stuff. That's channeled through the environment already, so it's already a selective complex phenomenon. But within the girl, she's already carrying her own filters or influences that come from her own life, her own background, things which are not culturally formed in the way that we normally mean. So she takes a walk through the forest. That is influencing her cultural assimilation. But we wouldn't normally call her walk through the forest part of culture. Right, but we're forgetting, if we reduce everything that's an external influence to culture, we tend to miss things that form a person that we don't normally see as culturally defined. So we get a different view. Right? Religious tradition is thus itself a complex flesh that has changed even as it is assimilated into the self. Indeed, this is how religious tradition itself grows. The subject serves as a creative matrix. So, this complexity of the process of cultural embodiment is anchored in Gadamer's idea of concepts and their manifestation in actual instances of understanding. So his philosophical core idea of how meaning functions is really what he's talking about here. He's just applying it to the individual. And where the dominant scientific and logical conception of concepts seeks to constrain their ambiguities so that they can be concisely applied. So science and logic, both science and philosophy want to shut down this and reduce the big, 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 wide, complex text. That's because they have practical applications to concise activity in relation to the natural world in science and concise activity in relation to logical structure in philosophy. But we can look at other discourses to be reminded of the more complex nature of cultural influence. Poetry is a useful discourse in this respect. Poetry reminds us that ideas are elusive and complex, opening out onto the wider range of meaning. Gadamer writes, the part of a lived reality that can enter into the concept is always a flattened version, like every projection of a living bodily existence onto a flattened surface. So whenever we capture something in a text, in any concept, in fact, we're getting a reduced version of it already. Right? So whenever we talk about any expression or manifestation, even within the mind and concepts, we're always getting a reduced shorthand, if you like. But that's not to say that the other aspects that created that concept aren't still working within the mind, within the person, within society. He writes, lived reality itself then provides a level of meaning that augments, destabilizes, relativizes, and enlivens concrete text of any kind. Language resonates through many different functions of language, more and less concise, determinate, elusive, evocative, and in the same way the cultural text of the self forms a complex, organic, living, and dynamic body. And this model is neither conservative in the normal way, nor radically subversive. We're not completely radically free. No one really argues that anymore, I think. But rather, it involves a two-tiered level model of the self. So the outer tier, you have this dynamic embodiment and cultural materials. Question, what is the inner tier of the self, then? If the outer tier is the cultural text, can we speak of an inner self? Right, and in some ways, this is a very problematic and taboo question. It's one that gets raised as a book by Žižek that has bits that I quite like, called The Ticklish Subject, The Absent Center of Political Ontology, where he talks about the problems of constructivism, that you only ever talk about the self as a social phenomenon, you never talk about whatever is the inner self that generates, that reflects, that subverts, that feels, etc. There's the idea that we haven't succeeded in having a very good model of what's going on at the interior of the self these days. So at the level of the inner tier, the self can be seen as a space in which unexpressed ideas, text, environments, all undergo an unseen process of mixing together, mutually influencing each other, and being woven into new expressions. Although this inner level is irreducibly invisible, this process must not be elided from any model of the self. And it represents a level of society and a religious tradition that needs to be factored into every implicit history of society and of culture. Right? So there is always, underneath these texts that are expressed, this hidden kind of pot in which things are being mixed together. And what comes out will never show you everything that's happening inside the pot. Right? And actually, something I've been meaning to finish writing on sociology kind of reflects this idea. We tend to try and interpret social causality in history in terms of the social text that we see in action. And every once in a while, you get something that is unpredictable according to that social text. Right? If sociology can be seen as a predictive science, because one of the original goals of sociology was to perform models by which you could predict what's going to happen next in society, then it fails because you do get weird stuff happening. And often what is the causality behind the weird stuff? You ought to be able to feed all social material into a machine and get out the next stage. But in fact, the interior of the individual, decision-making, motivations, emotions, forces, considerations, the subconscious, if you like, all of that influences these things. And that's most visible when you get what's sometimes called world historical individuals, people like Napoleon, people like various different figures who come up with something innovative and new because something in them is mixing up the social text in hidden ways. And suddenly you get a new production because we couldn't see how that was being generated because it was hidden, quote-unquote, inside the person. And that's interesting, and it kind of relates to Gadamer's idea that unless you can see what happens at those levels that aren't so culturally available, and that may include emotions, it may include the subtle influences like taking walks through forests, etc. What forms a person at that level, you're not going to be able to ever come up with a reasonable model. And of course that means you really can't ever come up with a full model of culture, society, or any given individual precisely because those things are invisible. They are irreducibly indivisible. As soon as they express what's going on inside them to you, it has become the concept. And as he said, the concept is always a flattened version of the reality within. As soon as they express it to themselves, if you've ever written a letter where you try and express complex, deep feelings that have been developed, love letters are really funny that way, because you're trying to express something that's very complex, and you yourself don't even quite know what's going on. So, and you put it into a text, which now becomes a representation, and that text is a net that captures some of what you're thinking and feeling, but not all of it. And often you have to hope that the reader on the other side of the text gets that this is not the whole of you. Right? That there's what is unsaid, what is ambiguous, what is unclear, that your expression is always limited, partial. So you always have to factor in what is irreducibly invisible into the individual, into the text, and into society. This process must not be elided. It is subject to principles of ambiguity, elusiveness, and potentiality. And Gadamer mostly examines these things, actually, through the example of poetic language. So if you look at his publications on poetry and poetry interpretation, one gets a profound and quite rich exploration of those themes. Here, too, he also explores it through the notion of the inner word of Augustinian hermeneutics. So you get those hermeneutic thinkers who try and explain religious texts in terms of an explicit message. But you get those like Augustine, who says the word that you read is always subject to an inner word, which you cannot get to, which is hidden and mysterious, but from which the manifested word emerges. This is an idea that Gadamer referred to repeatedly as a pivotal concept in his thought, although it receives relatively little attention. John Arthos wrote a book called The Inner Word in Gadamer's Hermeneutics that highlights this inner dimension of language for Gadamer, showing the way in which the theological concept of a latent spirit level of language in society provides a necessary counterpart to the already expressed incarnate part of culture. So for Gadamer, this is an important idea, and it links strongly to the process of self-understanding. You're always trying to understand not only the external text, but your self-text. And this idea holds a special place in his philosophy, as we'll see next week. It links to his notion of spirituality, actually. His own model of what the spiritual is linked strongly to his mother's religious background. So his father was a secular scientist, but his mother was a German pietist. And for him, the pietist tradition that he semi-inherited from her, he was not himself religious, but I've been told by someone who knew him that he slept with a Bible by his bed, he read it often, he inherited his mother's spiritual works. And he came out of that German tradition that says, don't speak of doctrine, don't speak of dogma, you needn't worry about the external realities, the inner work that you do on yourself is the true core of religion. And for him, that's really important. So he says that the idea in Augustine doesn't actually refer at all to an unshakable certainty of self-consciousness. It's not a Cartesian inner self in Augustine where you go, here I am, I think, therefore I am, I see my true self, that's my soul, I hold to that center. Rather, he says, it has a pietistic undertone, suggesting precisely that one cannot succeed in understanding oneself. For who we are is something unfulfillable, an ever-new undertaking and an ever-new defeat. So he warns against the reduction of the self. He warns that we can't reduce ourselves to ourself because we are ever new. We cannot be fulfilled, and yes, we must be ever new, yet we must ever newly undertake the exploration, the development, the cultivation of the self. And we have to be willing to be ever newly defeated, he says, by this process. So in lieu of a true self, he advocates an indeterminate core, and make surprisingly enthusiastic use of the idea of a soul as an incorporeal, shifting, and mysterious, yet fecund phenomenon. So like the poet Paul, actually, yes, he has wonderful images from Celan's poetry, actually, which I'll read. So like the poet Paul Celan's use of the image of the breath crystal, to which Gadamer devoted a whole collection of essays. He published a collection of essays on Celan's poetry, and a collection called the breath crystal. He likes this image, the way that this image describes the emergence of formless breath as an interior phenomenon into the fixed words of language. So language is a breath crystal, crystallization of this inner space. And in this way, the self ultimately eludes any determinate shape because it's really the breath that you are, and the breath is breathing and speaking again, again, and again. Thus, while it is the embodied self that produces the concrete texts of history, culture, and scripture, those texts with which recent thinkers like Charles Taylor, Judith Butler, and others have been concerned, it's from this insubstantial core self that the inner word, described by Augustine, emerges, producing a kind of meaning that stirs the unformed soul to its silent sort of fermentation and active creativity. So these are the two tiers of the soul. So life, functionally then, the layers of the self are at least twofold, fertile mystery, bodied word and expression, and both are always changing and interacting. Life itself consists of the process by which the indeterminate inner space becomes organic cultural body and passes back again into an obscure interaction of as yet unexpressed influences which are combining. Many of the Celan poems that he focuses on hint at the process in which words are dug out and then fall again into silence and come to play in the world like the play of light or a play on words. One particular poem seemed to speak of the process of meaning formation to him. The Life Mountain is a quote from the Celan poem, The Life Mountain. From its soil, you need anew our names. A tree, high thought strikes the light sound. There are still songs to sing, but beyond humankind. So there's a mountain, as it were, that is life, and its soil is what names are being needed anew. So again, a cyclical process of a kind of a raw material becoming name. And with this, or out of this, he contrasts the tree, which is high thought, so something like a more developed cultural expression, which strikes the light sound. So the thought hits this light, which then manifests in something, again, like the breath crystal, something seeable, visible, and more sharply defined. He says, but there are always still songs to sing beyond humankind. So back, if you like, to that hidden source, songs are always ready to emerge. We never stop with any given expression. So creating his own poetic cluster of meaning from this piece, Gadamer suggests that with all of our accumulating experience, we are the life mountain. And the poem describes the shaping of our identity from the whole of our experience of the world, which is constructed out of this material of experience and must be constantly needed anew. I'm going to stop there, but he goes on and he explores the way in which the title of his Celan readings, called Who Am I and Who Are You, captures his fascination with the idea that the I who speaks the poem is demonstrating at every moment. So you read the poem, it describes something, but the poem itself, with its ambiguity, and Celan's poetry is highly ambiguous, famous for it, is about your recognizing that these words are only a partial expression of something underneath the poem, which is always challenging, waiting, emerging, and pushing at your awareness. And that's...
Where is that written? Sorry.
It's in a collection called Gadamer on Celan, Who Am I and Who Are You? And Other Essays, published by SUNY, State University of New York. Gadamer on Celan, Who Am I and Who Are You? So really for him, two points come out of it, or three points, that the self is this dynamic process, that the self is not only constructed but makes itself, and society, and there is a need for an active turn to self-making. To be aware of that is to be able to take control of that process. And a reminder that the community, culturally, and the community of individual persons, functions in a sense as your extended self. So you can actually have a threefold self. There's the inner mystery, there's your culture body, and then there's the wider self, which is the community that you are constantly interacting with and creating, right? Society, culture itself is your big self.
And nature.
And nature, yeah, and that's right. I mean, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you can see community, world as combining those, but I think that's right. That's important for Gadamer, that one should never reduce the external world to just the cultural world.
He would say that the nature is not a cultural sort of phenomenon, our experience of nature.
Well, both, I mean, again, it's one of these things where there's culture, there's nature. Both, and when we talk about hermeneutics and text and culture, we tend to elide the nature side. Because he's a phenomenologist, both of those are actually manifestations of experience, if you like, or of meaning, right? So again, they're actually part of the same external, quote-unquote external, part of the same reality. You know, being, if you like, encompasses both of those. Consciousness encompasses both of those. But you're right. The way people tend to interpret that is only one part. And that means you always ignore the stuff that isn't allied with actual particular historical cultural traditions. You know, I think it's important that, you know, the moment when you wake up, you look out the window, you watch the tree moving, you daydream for a bit, you go for a walk, you do things which are harder to see, it's harder to see their cultural connection. Those are just as influential, right? And the fact that we can't capture them easily doesn't mean that we get to ignore them, because you'll always come up with a flawed model, if you see what I mean. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to stop there. So any comments?